what the world teaches us that mistakes are bad. I mean, just, you know, go back to any simple childhood memory where you did something wrong and you made a mistake and the mistake was punished. What we're taught is that making mistakes is bad so that we should avoid them. But what we really should be taught, it's not about avoiding mistakes. It's about error recovery. It's about making mistakes and actually being able to recover quickly from them. When you make a mistake and recover quickly just a couple of times, there's a part of you, a light switch that flicks on and says, wow, I actually learned something really valuable. I got comfortable being uncomfortable, and now I'm better because of it.
All right, welcome back, or welcome to the Finding Mastery podcast. I'm Michael Gervais, and by trade and training, I'm a sport and performance psychologist, as well as the co-founder of Compete to Create. And I just got to say, 2020 already is incredibly exciting. And so I hope it is for you. And if you're on the other side of it and you're struggling, you know, I hope you're finding some peace in knowing that all things are temporary. So that being said, the whole idea behind these conversations is to learn, but to learn from people who have committed their life efforts towards mastery. And what we want to do is we want to not just learn for the sake of consumption, but learn in a way that has clear application. And in doing that, we want to set the context for how do these extraordinary people organize their inner life? Like, what is their psychological framework? How do they make sense of themselves, their purpose in life? How do they explain events, something as small as people rolling their eyes to something as like grand as, you know, I don't know, catastrophes that are happening across our planet. So that's the big stuff. And then we double click underneath of that to get a sense of the mental skills that they use to build and refine their craft. Finding Mastery is brought to you by listening. This is exactly what their app does. It helps you listen to books and content that you might not be able to sit down and actually have the time to read. There was a time in early in my career where I remember sitting in the back hallways of my university and being in the library for hours, reading all of the sports psychology literature and research that I could get my hands on. I loved it. I cherished it. The field of sports psychology is just absolutely on a bender right now. It is growing so fast. It is nearly impossible to keep up with all of the research that's coming out. So that's why I love what listening is doing. It's a game changer for me. So the listening app, it lets me listen to anything that's in writing while I'm on the go. Everything from academic papers to books, PDFs, web pages, articles, anything that I put in their app, it reads it to me. It narrates to me. And plus their AI is great. The way that the interface sounds, like, of course, it's not a human that's reading, but it kind of, the AI is so good of what they're doing. It just works. And then there's also this note-taking function. They know that people like us like to take notes. And so it's as simple as when I hear a key idea, I instantly press a button and that section is saved. They've done a really nice job with this product and they've got a great offer for us. Usually they only give a 2-week trial, but because you are listening to Finding Mastery, you get a whole month for free. Check that out, a whole month for free. So I want to encourage you to go check it out. listening.com/findingmastery or use the code findingmastery at checkout to get started. Again, it's listening.com/findingmastery. Or use the code FINDINGMASTERY at checkout to get 1 month completely free. Finding Mastery is brought to you by Hims. Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing simple, convenient, and affordable access to science-informed treatments for erectile dysfunction, known as ED. They also are servicing hair loss, weight loss, and more. Health struggles like ED, they're common, but they can be hard to talk about when it comes to finding a solution. That's why Hims has been a game changer for so many men. The entire process is 100% online. Answer a series of questions on their site, and a medical provider will determine the right treatment option for you. If prescribed, your medication ships directly to you for free in a discreet package. No waiting rooms, no pharmacy visits, and no insurance is needed. Plus, you can manage your plan directly on the Hims app. You can track progress and learn more about your conditions and how to treat them from leading medical experts. If you or a loved one has been struggling with ED, I really want to encourage you to go check out Hims. I know ED often has a psychological component to it as well. So be sure that you're stacking some psychological best practices into your daily routine. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/findingmastery. That's Hims, HIMS.com/findingmastery for your personalized ED treatment options. Hims.com/findingmastery. Disclaimer, hard mints are chewable compounded products which are not approved by or verified for safety or effectiveness by the FDA. Prescriptions require an online consultation with a healthcare provider who will determine if appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for details and important safety information. Subscription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. Okay, this week's conversation is with Chase Jarvis. He's an award-winning artist. He's also a legit entrepreneur who's built something really special. And he's one of the most influential photographers over the past 20 years. And he's got a ridiculous body of work that ranges from, you know, shooting advertising campaigns, all the slick, glossy stuff that moves the zeitgeist and culture, you know, stuff like Apple and Nike and Red Bull, to him down in the trenches working with athletes like Serena and Tony Hawk and collaborating with, you know, massive icons like Lady Gaga and Richard Branson. And so then back in 2013, Chase contributed to the Pulitzer Prize winning New York Times story Snowfall. And in 2014, he earned an Emmy nomination for his documentary Portrait of a City. I mean, what a cool body of work. And on the entrepreneurial side, he created Best Camera, which was the first photo app to share images to social networks. And in a much, I don't know, more disruptive way, he's the founder of Creative Live, where more than 10 million students learn photography, video, design, music, business from the world's top creators and entrepreneurs. And he was radically disruptive in how he did this. And he's made a dent in the creative world and in the teaching world. And it's awesome. And he also has a new book, Creative Calling, which debuted as an instant national bestseller. And I think that you can probably infer from what this conversation is about, it's really about creativity, but more specifically, how you can unlock and unscrew and untwist and unravel your creative potential. And we really talk about what that means. Like, we all have it. We all have that ability to express artistically. However, it requires some work. And so we get into that in this conversation. So with that, let's jump right into this conversation with Chase Jarvis. Chase, how you doing?
I'm happy to be on the show. Thanks for having me.
Oh, cool. What a good vibe to start with. Where are you in the world?
I am up about an hour north of Seattle at a little beach called Madrona Beach that's been in my – it's a little cabin, little shag carpet, wood panel cabin that's been in my family for – well, the dirt has been in my family, get this, for 100 years.
Look at that.
My great aunt's mom bought it for $10, and I'm looking out at the Pacific Ocean.
Come on. Were they pioneer spirits, or like, how did they get to the coast? That, yeah.
It evoked an image of a covered wagon and
yeah,
settlers. No, but it wasn't that far from that. They used to take, I think it was a Model A Ford. It would take them 9 hours to get here from Seattle, and then they had to hike the last mile over this ridge down into the beach area. Now it takes 55 minutes from my house in Seattle to get here via car. But it's been in the family for, like I said, just a couple years shy of 100, and this is where I do my best relaxing and also my best thinking. So sure. I've been doing more of the former over the course of the weekend here, but super happy to be on the show. I'm in a very relaxed place and excited to focus on our conversation.
That's what's up. And you know, what's funny is that, you know, we know many of the same folks from the circles that we travel in. We've never met. I work in Seattle, and we haven't been able to pin each other down to meet in person. So thank God for the advent of technology to be able to do this with you. And so I'm stoked. I'm in LA today, and weather's perfect. It's amazing. And so we're both in a good spot. And so let's start really quickly. So this conversation is going to hub around your insights, your framework about how you've become and done what you do. And more importantly, it's about like how you've organized your inner life to go explore. And your world is really around, as I understand at least, correct me if I'm off here, is about creativity. And so much so that you were infused with a brand that, as a founder, that many people would recognize in Creative Live. And so as an online technology for learning. And can you just quickly talk about that, or course correct me wherever I had some mistakes in there? Yeah,
I'm happy to. It's something I'm really proud of. And it also, like most things in life, was very far from a straight line, right? It was all over the place, as so many of the best things in our lives are. I think the story, it goes way back to my childhood when I saw myself as creative just through as a normal course of operating as a kid. And then I came to find out that, well, creativity is this thing that is not very well understood by pop culture, and certainly not the culture that I was raised in. And even, you know, just you can see where it stems out of the 50s and 60s and 70s, where it was sort of the beaver cleaver, like, you know, you go to this school and you get this job and you get this degree, get this job, and then you go to work for 40 years and get the gold watch. And, you know, I didn't understand how creativity's place sat in that universe. Fast forward a number of years, and I through the death of my grandfather, was given his camera, and it unlocked a whole world for me where I was sort of like, wait a minute, this creativity stuff, it's not just painting and theater and movies and popsicle sticks and pipe cleaners like we're taught in school. This is like one of nature's, or one of the human being's, most powerful forces. So I managed to tap into that, create a living and a life for myself as a photographer. And that's where our, you know, keep talking about where our lives intersect, and you know, a lot of action sports photography. So we crossed paths there. And as you were working with high performance athletes, I was photographing them. So
I know that is funny that we've been working in the same places, but I don't know if it's funny, but yeah.
The same people and the same brands. And so at any rate, my world ultimately was shaped by unlocking what I would consider my creative potential, which really started outlining or dictating or helping shape my human potential. And I was like, God, man, what if there's a way that I can help other people experience what has been this massive unlock for me? And I think it really does tip into human performance, not just like on a sports level, but intellectually, that creativity is more than just art. It's creativity with a capital C, is like solving massive human problems. And so I started tinkering around with sharing information online in the early 2000s, built up a large social following. And then I thought, what if we could formalize this and make it a place where amazing people came to teach, and that the world could tap into these experts' brains? And so in 2010, I did a little experiment with a photography class that I brought a friend of mine in to teach, and we were going to make this class available for free online. Anybody could watch it, and if you wanted to own it and watch it over and over again, then you could buy it. And we launched it, and 50,000 people attended this photography class. And that's sort of, we realized we had a tiger by the tail when our first class had that many people in it. And yeah, that was class one. And now here we are about 10 years later, we've done nearly 3,000 classes, with, you know, anything in photography, design, filmmaking, entrepreneurship, names like Sir Richard Branson, Tim Ferriss, Brené Brown, you know, many of the world's top thinkers are, this is where they go to teach and share their knowledge.
And how did you get 50,000 out the gate? What'd you do for that? Like, was that part of your community? Was it strong at that point?
Mm-hmm. It was the community that I'd built from just sharing ideas online. In a pre-YouTube world, I started telling stories about that earlier part of my life that I was sharing with you just a moment ago, about unlocking my own creative potential and understanding that creativity wasn't just, you know, creativity wasn't just art. It was like creativity with a capital C, was this very powerful thing that separates humans from all the other species on the planet. And started documenting my journey, not just primarily as a photographer, but in the larger sense, as someone who identified overtly as, wait a minute, I'm a creator, and I not only can I create photos and businesses, but I'm actually creating my life in the process of understanding, you know, understanding this thing called creativity. And so I built a community from sharing online my journey, and, you know, probably had about a million monthly readers of my blog. And so when we launched Creative Live, it was really easy for me just to say, hey, everybody in my community, I'm doing this thing. And voila, it was, the community wanted to learn and wanted to learn from someone beyond just me. And so I sort of plugged them into that. And as I said, we were off to the races.
Mm, golly. Okay. I get how you got there, right? Is that you've been on this authentic journey about understanding the applications of creativity, using yourself as, you know, tier zero, ground zero experiment, sharing those insights and what you're doing, building a community of people that were vibing around this word and this lifestyle of creativity. I think I understand that. I do want to get to some of the business stuff about how you built it, but let's first go backwards, because when I say backwards, like earlier days, when you were describing when your grandfather passed away and he gave you a camera, what was the relationship like with your grandfather? And maybe that's a red herring, and that's not where this conversation needs to go, but definitely I want to understand your relationship with your camera, but what was your family dynamic like?
Sure. I love this. I've got some questions for you on the psychology part of this. Like, yeah, I don't even know the answers to these questions, but we'll go there. We'll see what turns out.
Okay. Hold on that note, what does it take for you, like even in this moment, to go to a place that you haven't maybe talked about or gone? Like, what's happening for you right now in this conversation?
Enthusiasm. You know, I've got a new book out called Creative Calling. And the fun part about having a new book is that you get to talk about the thing that you've been working on for years. But the flip side of that same coin is that so much press just looks and feels the same. And honestly, that's why I was really excited to come on your show, because I know your show as you don't just trot out the headlines, you know, actual conversation.
So then if I drill in one more, like double click into it, like when you're like, oh, okay, we're going to go somewhere about my grandfather, like in places I haven't been, where does that happen in your body, and what happens in your body?
Oh, very much a chest feeling for me. Very much. To me, I'm a huge, huge advocate, and I write at length about intuition. Mm-hmm. And we're taught very largely in our culture that rational thought, that the mind is, you know, this is where all of the default thinking and doing and all that stuff happens. And what I understand about rational thought now, having looked into it and been oriented toward creativity and intuition over the past chapter of my life, I realized that rational thought, while it may be powerful, is also laden with bias. It's reasonably slow, and it has a very narrow lens on what's possible, because the brain is designed not to keep you happy or make you feel fulfilled, but it's designed to keep you alive. So you've got, I call it the brain rather than your brain, because it's just an organ and you need to learn how to program that. And to me, part of the lens through which we should program it is through our intuition and more for our body knowledge. And I think we're early on in the science that understands how memories and thoughts and all that can be stored in the body at a cellular level. That's more what I think of intuition. And so when you ask the question, for me, it was very much like, oh, cool, we're going somewhere. And it was heart, chest, body, rather than head. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, that's, I don't know what the, you know, maybe you can tell me what's going on psychologically there.
Well, no, like I think the next question we'll get to it, which is like, when you feel that thing, what do you do with it?
Oh, and I think this is a very much a learned behavior, and that's part of what the book is about and part about what my shtick is as a person who looks at the world through our ability to create the living, the life, the experience that we want from this one trip around. And that is, like, you've got to trust this part of you. Very much a learned behavior. It's not taught in our culture to trust our intuition. Intuition is thought to be flimsy and whimsical and naive, and I'm just the opposite. So when what happens in my body is a very comfortable place where I'm getting asked about a thing that I've learned to hone and to trust, and there's an excitement of getting to share this with someone in their community who actually takes interest and understands this. There's a huge piece of the, you know, of my book about creativity is understanding this more, not necessarily as a map, because our intuition, what we're sold in culture, is a map, right? You start here, you take this route, and then you end here. And the funny thing is, the irony is that nobody's map ever looks, no one's experience ever maps to the map that we were sold. Even if it was like, oh, you got to go to college, then you get this degree, and then you get this job. Like, it doesn't happen like that. That's what we're sold. But rather, what actually happens, the experience, if you deconstruct the lives of the world's most fulfilled people, top performers, is that there's a compass. And this compass that is very, it orients, if we know how to listen to it, it orients towards our true north. And the thing about a compass is that you don't have the whole journey, right? You just got an arrow. And this is how, you know, intuition sort of comes into being in not just a life scale in the macro, but in this moment right here with you. Like, I don't know where this conversation's going, mm-hmm. but I'm willing to explore it with you because I've learned to trust this piece of me, which I think is extraordinarily powerful.
Okay, I want to talk to you about a new sponsor right here, Hydro. I love what they're doing. They are awesome. I don't know if you're into rowing like I am. I really enjoy it. What I try to do is I try to move around different cardio exercises. Sometimes on a bike, sometimes I'm rowing, sometimes I'm outside. But when I want to row, they've got it dialed in. They've done something fundamentally different than all the other rowers. One, it's not this loud machine that is making a ton of noise and, you know, chains slapping all over the place. They've done this in a really slick, premium, elevated way. And then the other thing they've done is that there's a nice screen that you can have a guide or a coach with you. And their coaches are Olympians and world-class athletes. And what they've done is they're filming, full stop, they are filming all over the world on places where their experts are rowing, and then you get to go with them. And they're coaching you the whole way. I love it. My favorite coach by far is Mac. She's great. And I just want to encourage you to give them a shot. If you love rowing, I think you're going to love this machine. And if you're not into rowing, I don't know if you know this, but rowing, there's been some research around rowing that rowing engages over 80% of your muscles while you're doing it. So it's a really efficient exercise. This spring, join the growing rowing community at Hydro. Head over to hydro.com and use the code MASTERY to save up to $400 off your Hydro. That's hydro.com, hydrow.com, and use the code MASTERY to save up to $400. Hydro.com, use the code MASTERY. Finding Mastery is brought to you by AG1. It's really important to me that the supplements I take are of the highest quality. And that's why for almost a decade now, I've been drinking AG1. When I first was connected with them, I thought, oh, this is great. This is great. And then I double-clicked to understand their process and how they went about it. And I just love the rigor that goes into what they're creating and the product that they have. And they've gone through so many iterations to get it just right, 52 of them to be exact. Sometimes quality can be a buzzword, but they are committed. They are fundamentally committed to have a great product for us. They're interested in absorption. They're interested in high quality manufacturing. They rigorously test their product. So I trust what's in AG1. And one of the reasons I have extra confidence in that statement is they are NSF certified for sport. That's one of the most rigorous independent quality and safety certification programs in the supplement industry. They've made it so easy as well. What I do every morning is I take a scoop, put it into a cup of water, shake it up, and it's the first thing that I put in my stomach. And I love it. It just gives me the sense like, okay, I've invested in my health and I haven't even started my day yet. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, I want to encourage you to go check out AG1. So try AG1 and get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D3, K2, and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription at drinkag1.com/findingmastery. Again, that's drinkag1.com/findingmastery. I hope you would check them out. I'm nodding my head in a lot of different moments of what you're talking about, because if we work backwards, the ability to trust oneself, to be able to adjust to the unfolding, unpredictable, unknown, is the mark of somebody who has developed an inner life that can stand in the face of a rugged, challenging, unpredictable world. And how do we develop that sense of trust? Well, we got to do difficult shit. And I don't mean get your heart rate up and hold yourself on the side of a cliff through by your fingernails and like do. I'm not talking about that necessarily. Like, we can use our environment, and our environment can be help shape moments for us to understand and explore our inner life, which are, how do our thoughts and our embodied cognition, how does our brain and our body speak and relate to our mind? Like, how does this thing work? And the difficult work is the emotional work. It's not the mental exercise. Like, what is that? Like, mentally hard work? I don't even know what that is. And I'm a psychologist. It's not mentally hard work. It's the emotional work of being on the edges of comfort. And so that's why I was asking, when you felt your body, and what maybe there was like, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but just knowing basic physiology, it was like maybe it was up in your chest. That means maybe there was a breathing change, a quick little breathing, maybe it increased, or maybe it moved up in your chest, or maybe there's a heart thump, or maybe there was a temperature change. I don't know. Or maybe it was a constriction, like there was some tension, but something, you had a physiological thing. And then what I hear you saying is, you said, okay, I am aware of intuition, how my body speaks to me, and I'm going to stay in it. I'm not going to shut it off and say, oh shit, someone's going to find out that I'm nervous, or my body's activated, or that you say, oh, there it is. So it's awareness without judgment. And then you follow it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let me flip the script here for a second and ask you a similar question.
So,
like, as a master psychologist,
we got labels now.
Like, you are also entering, there's no rehearsal that's happened, right? We just agreed that we were going to get on the phone and record it and share our experiences with anyone who wanted to listen. And so, you know, what's the lens that you look at this moment? To me, we're co-creating this moment. This is where, you know, you're basing, I think, the lens that I'm understanding you're looking at this through is psychology and physiology and all of the areas that you're a master in and have studied. I'm thinking about, like, we're co-creating this moment, and there's a certain amount of trust. I'm willing to go there. There's a certain amount of trust. You're willing to go there. But what's the lens that you're looking at it through?
Yeah, cool. Okay. So I want to share two things with you. One is, and I'll back into the lens that I'm looking through it with. And so you wouldn't know this because we don't know each other, but my philosophy, and I spent a lot of time trying to understand, like, what is my true north, and what is the underlying philosophy that's going to help guide my thoughts, my words, and my actions when my compass is attuned. So I'm looking for true north as well, back to your second or one of your points that you're making. But to do that, because I know what north is, but I don't know the next step and what step I need to take. But I do know that I have to have a philosophy. And that philosophy is going to guide my thoughts, my words, and my next step, my actions. So when I tell you my philosophy, I think you're going to go, oh, okay. So, I've spent a lot of time like trying to sort this out. And it's going to sound easy and eloquent, but it's spent many years in the woodshed trying to sort it out. So here it is. Every day is an opportunity to create a living masterpiece. Okay, so I struggled with the word create. It's one of my most important words. And matter of fact, it's the name, part of the name of the company that I just recently built with Coach Carol. It's called Compete to Create, Create a Living Masterpiece. But I struggle with the word because I wasn't sure if I, like, what was right, co-create or create, because I believe that this is a co-creation process. And there's a spiritual dimension to that, and then a human to human dimension, and a human to and with nature element. Because we're not in this alone. No one does it alone. No one does the extraordinary or the discovery process purely alone. There are elements that are quiet and reflective. So to get to your point, like, how am I doing it? Like, I'm all about getting into the unknown. And my team I drive them nuts because I don't want to prepare. I want to know where you've been, what you're doing, but I don't want to over prepare and try to find like, oh, I'm going to go this way and that way in this conversation. I've got 12 questions. I want to understand. So my lenses is really like this naive exploratory approach. And I do love when my heart rate gets up and we can get into uncharted, you know, maps. And, you know, there is no map. I don't know, at least. I know I've got breadcrumbs that I've left behind, and so do you, right? Creative Live's a pretty big breadcrumb, by the way. Like, that's pretty significant.
To me, there's just this amazing overlap between our two worlds, and that we're coming. And to me, this is part of what, you know, I'd aimed to capture in the book, honestly, because this has been elusive for a long time. Like, I'm coming at this. My experience is, wait a minute, when I realized that, you know, that I could take pictures every day and, you know, write 1,000 blog posts on my blog and create a business in Creative Live, and that, wait a minute, these are all like, these are activities that people don't necessarily think of as creative, but here I am. There's so much overlap between, I also have a podcast where I've had all these, you know, the world's top performers on there. I mentioned Creative Live. So I get this experience of having what I'm thinking and my personal philosophy overlap with so many, and this is happening right here with us, right? That the fact that your company is called Compete to Create, like when we really distill it, creativity is so fundamental.
Yeah.
Like I'm looking at it as I'm creating my day from the moment that I wake up. I decided to go out and get in the 51 degree water and, you know, shock my system such that make it uncomfortable and make it realize that I am the boss of my psychology, and I'm going to tell it to get uncomfortable for a second, even if it's in a physiological way, getting into super cold water. And then I'm going to come in and create breakfast and spend some time visualizing and et cetera, et cetera. And to then, you know, flip the script and hear how you were coming at, you know, this, our conversation today, you're like, you don't know where it's going to go. And that's actually part of what gets you exciting or excited.
Yeah.
This is the experience that I have from so many of my friends that are, you know, amazing performers, is that there's this element of making stuff happen. Like I crack up when people are like, oh, you're the founder of Creative Live. And I'm always boggled, like, founder, I didn't find anything. I built that shit.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
It's bizarre. It's like, or just, finding fulfillment. No. This is not something that we stumble upon in the woods and like, oh, here's a bucket of fulfillment. You know, you have to actually, you're putting all of your faculties at work to work in order to make this beautiful, messy thing that we call happiness or fulfillment or connection or whatever the word you want to use. That is such an active process that, to me, that's where, again, I then sort of distill it down to, oh, it was created. You can talk about making or doing or all those things, but I like to think of it as creating because it helps sew my personal narrative and the lens that I see the world through into one more tidy package.
Yeah. And so Albert Bandura is one of the great psychologists of our era. And he came along and disrupted the field, saying, you know, and the field was heavily bent towards, well, there's a stimulus and you respond to it. And then that creates your neural patterns. And then you're more akin and more likely to respond to that stimulus in the same way by strengthening the response to the environment and the stimulus. And he comes along and says, whoa, hold on now. Wait a minute. We're agents. We have agency in our life. And we are literally, to your language, co-creating and responding to ways of our choice each moment. And yes, there's some habitual patterns that you and I both have and all humans have. But when we're awake and we're aware that we can navigate moment to moment based on either intuition or based on compass or a combination of both. And so, you know, Bandura was like a massive influence for me on this discovery process of figuring out, like, how do I really want to do my life? And what are the ways that I can influence my internal skills to be able to navigate well?
I love it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really good.
It is. It's so, it's like, it feels, I don't know, it feels like a system to me. And for I'm doing air quotes here, a creative or someone who identifies as creative, I think there's this label that means we're, you know, we're sort of running around in the woods with no clothes on, like looking at the stars. And I'm actually a really structured thinker. You know, my background, I bailed on a PhD in philosophy partway through because I didn't feel like it was delivering on the thing that I thought it was going to deliver on. And so this idea of a structured approach to something that can be wildly creative, to me, that is art and science coming together to, it's like alchemy, for example. And it seems like that's the lens that you're coming at this through. And probably if our worlds continue to overlap in the way that I think they will, when you work with a world-class athlete and you deconstruct, you know, their performance cues and their psychology, that it's very similar to that of, you know, any one of the world's top artists or the entrepreneurs. Like there's this, this alchemy, a series of things that we know we can put our finger on. Then there's a bunch of intangibles, and you put that together in some sort of a structure, and you just get, you get elite performance. You get the highest, you know, quality output from whatever your individual potential is. To me, that's very, very exciting. And that's, you know, I wanted to take, I love that you said like the part of the word that, or part of the name of your company that sort of, you didn't have a good, you couldn't pin down was the create part.
Right.
That's like literally what I'm trying to do. That's part of my life mission, is to make that word not scary and just like, no, don't worry about it. You're a creating machine. You're constantly choosing, if you look at it as free will, or if you look at it as just a way to go about the world, go about your day, go about your, ultimately your life. I wanted to draw that, you know, put my arms around something bigger, this creativity with the capital C that I keep talking about. And that, you know, that means that the book, that my life is not just for people who identify. Sure, if you identify as a creator, this is going to be helpful. It's going to accelerate everything you do. But there's this part, there's this pool of humans who I would put you in that pool. Like, I understand enough about creativity to use the word. I also don't understand enough to be sort of trepidatious about how to couch my sort of quote creative instincts. And I think if we can make a bigger pie and make that word less scary, that is another way that we can crack into our highest performing best selves.
Okay. I love it. So I want to go underneath the word create for just a minute and understand the skills that you've built to be able to not become accidental in what you're creating, like, oh, this thing happened, but lack the inability to sustain a creative approach to life. So I want to go underneath and get the skills, and we can use your craft as the laboratory, the working laboratory, or we can use your, mastery of self. So there's mastery of self and mastery of craft, and the linking of the two is very special. And I feel bad for the people that are just, like, really, I have compassion for those that are just squarely interested in mastery of craft. And most people are not interested in mastery of craft without mastery of self, but most people are interested in like achievement or success or the substandard to mastery high performance. You know, so I'd like to go underneath and you take it either way, mastery of craft or mastery of self, but what are the skills that you have and that you're working on continuing to refine so that you can sustain a creative approach to life or craft?
Very, very thoughtful and powerful question. I love the relationship. So I'm going to first sort of trot this out, which is, I actually don't believe that you can master yourself until you master some craft. Because this is a personal belief that I learned through experience, and because you don't actually understand the concept of mastery until you've tapped into it. And so to go right to mastery of self without a vehicle through which to get there, I don't know how one does that, because there's not enough tactile stuff to see the results play out. That's just a lens that I'm going to put on it. But if we leave that out there for a second and just know that that's where I'm going, and then get to your question about skills, I think if you have to ask what mastery feels like, I don't think you've mastered anything. And I hope that for someone right now that is listening, they're like, oh man, that's a bummer. Chase just sort of turned me off. Because here's the flip side of the same coin, is that means that you have like the best stuff in front of you, which is the opportunity to master something. And I'm an advocate of mastering a craft, going back to your initial question. And in fact, it's the best way and the only way to get to mastery, like this capital M mastery. Well, when you look at someone who's totally world-class at something, and it doesn't have to be a big thing. It doesn't have to be is a billionaire business tycoon, or is a, you know, one of the world's best surgeons, or is one of the world's top guitar players. It doesn't have to be. It can be something. You can master something that is small, a personal domain for you. But when you've mastered something, you know it. And people ask me, well, when, like, I am a master in photography. Both I can say that word and not even bat an eyelash, because I've done thousands of shoots under immense amount of financial pressure, in the moment pressure with huge brands, and a lot riding on this, and you've got to thread the needle. And what a master does is a master just makes it happen. And when you've mastered something, the clues that you have around mastery are so powerful at informing other areas of your life. That is why you see someone, let's take someone, I don't know if you know Tim Ferriss very well. He's a dear friend of mine, and he wrote the, you know, he's got like 5 or 6 number one New York Times bestsellers, originally the 4-Hour Work Week, and then he's gone on, he's one of the top 5 or 10 podcasts in the world. So Tim is a master of, he's learned how he learns, and the guy has been like a world champion in salsa dancing, a world champion in, you know, some form of judo. He's written 5 New York Times best-selling books. He's got television shows. He's done, like, you start to see this with someone who has uncorked what I think is their own lens on how to master something. The cool thing is you get to then lift and stamp that into other areas. So if we can now, so if we pinned one thing to the map, to our whiteboard here, or our corkboard, I just pinned another thing, which is mastery is when you've mastered something, you can master a lot of things. Now let's go back to your very initial question, which is what are the skills? To me, the skills become they're ultimately very, very transferable, which is what is it that, you know, what are the top handful of things that I need to know in order to become very good at something? What are the handful of people that I can meet who can continue to inform, inspire, and unlock new aspects of this discipline or this craft for me? What are the characteristics, the mindset, if you will, of the master? And you know, you start to label big areas where if you just understand 80 or 90% of that area. Remember the 80-20 rule, right? Pareto's law. It's like it takes 20% of the time to learn 80% of information. If you can become so good at understanding, well, let's just use photography since it's my area that I mastered first in my life. And what I had to realize is that the technical aspect of it was very important, but that's like the walking and chewing gum. Like that is so fundamental, and people will spend a lot of time on it. I get that. That's, you know, that's a good area of focus. You have to be good at the craft, but that's just one element of mastery, right? The next element is working with your subject, whether that's a human being, an athlete, a nature landscape. You have to understand weather patterns. You have to understand, you know, there's all this nuance around the subject that you're going to focus on. And so understanding the subject is another area. If you've got to master your ability to understand shutter speed, aperture, ISO, all these basic elements that go into a good photograph, then you have to master what your learning what you're photographing. And then you have to master putting that work out in the world, right? How do you get that work seen? And how do you connect the work that you're doing with other people and move them and inspire them and make them feel connected to the work you've done? So there start to be a handful of buckets. And let's just fast forward in time and say, I got good at doing that in photography. And then through my podcast and through Creative Live, I was like, wait a minute, the people who are world-class thinkers and doers, they've taken this essentially a blueprint for mastery and just stamped it into other areas of their life. And instead of the craft being understanding the relationship between shutter speed and aperture and ISO in photography, it might be in breakdancing, understanding body mechanics and physiology and, you know, balance and strength. And once you understand those things, you know, there's analogous elements of every discipline that when you've mastered one thing, you can more easily master others.
Finding Master is brought to you by Apollo Neuro. By now, you're probably well aware that I am a huge fan of what they're doing. I love what they're building and how they're using science-backed technology to help people flourish. This is just a great technology that isn't measuring something. It's actually providing a state change for you to help you either downregulate, find a deeper sense of calm, maybe fall asleep a little bit easier. And if you want to be a bit more up and animated, they've got a way to help you do that as well. It's awesome. It works by sending silent, soothing vibrations. They call them Apollo vibes, of course. That's fun. It's like music that you can just feel. Just like music, higher vibrations help improve your energy and focus, while lower vibrations, slower vibrations, help to reduce stress, help you relax. I use it twice a day. I use it after I do something really intense. So after it's a lift, after some fitness, after some sport, or after something I'm doing in the office. And I use it right before I go to bed. The science that they've found is fascinating. Across various real-world and clinical trials, Apollo wearable users experience up to 40% less stress and feelings of anxiety. That's an average, of course. 19% more time in deep sleep, 11% increase in HRV, heart rate variability, and up to 25% more focus and concentration. Those are radical. And because you're a part of the Finding Mastery community, you're going to get an exclusive, and I mean that word here, 15% off an Apollo wearable. So just head to apolloneuro.com/findingmastery and use the code findingmastery at checkout. This is an exclusive offer only available to Finding Mastery. I love that we get to do this together. So be sure to use our code. Again, APOLLONEURO, apolloneuro.com/findingmastery, or use the code findingmastery at checkout for 15% off your purchase. You're only getting that here. I really hope you'll check them out. Finding Mastery is brought to you by AquaTrue. We all know how important hydration is to performance and recovery and well-being, but it's not just about how much you drink. The quality of your water plays a big role. And if you're like me and you don't fully trust tap water, and I think for good reason, research by the Environmental Working Group has shown that 3 out of 4 homes in the U.S. have harmful contaminants in tap water. That's why I'm really excited to introduce AquaTrue. Their purifiers use a 4-stage reverse osmosis purification process, and their countertop purifiers remove 15 times more contaminants than ordinary pitcher filters. It's incredible. I can literally taste the difference in my water. Plus, the filters are affordable and long-lasting. Just one set of filters from their classic purifier makes the equivalent of 4,500 bottles of water. That adds up to less than 3 cents per bottle. It feels great to know that all at once, I'm saving money, getting the highest quality water for the Finding Mastery team, and helping make a positive impact on the environment by eliminating single-use plastics all the way around. AquaTrue comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, and it even makes a great gift. And right now, because you're a Finding Mastery listener, you receive 20% off any AquaTrue purifier. So just go to aquatrue.com. You spell it AquaTru.com and enter the code FINDINGMASTERY at checkout. Again, that's aquatrue.com. Enter the Finding Mastery code at checkout to receive 20% off any purifier that you buy there. I love it. I mean, the clarity that you have of self first, both craft first, right? Understanding that craft and then your relationship to it, and then environment and others as you move outward. And then the third concentric circle is like, how do you actually move that into the world? And that third part is, sounds like, you know, why you develop Creative Live, why you've written Creative Calling. And so, right. And so I've often said, this is again, us like nodding our head to each other's thought patterns, is that mastery of self through craft, because the craft is the reflection of, it's the feedback loop and it's the response system of like, okay, this is the thing that I've felt inside and saw inside. And then I need to translate that out, whether it's a canvas or, you know, an athletic expression. I need to translate it somehow. And then during that translation, oftentimes it falls short. So then we go back and we've got this feedback loop between what we saw and felt, what we expressed. And then maybe other people need to help us with developing psychological skills or technical skills, and then putting those two together under said conditions to express again. And people that have mastered, they are authentically, artistically expressing what they have inside with high command when they express it. And true masters can do it across, you're going to laugh when I say this. My insight is that true masters can do it across any condition. Holy shit, right? Like, it's like, I'm listening to you going, hot damn, dude, like, how did you get here? Because I've spent my whole life trying to sort this out. It sounds like you have too.
I have. And I just, to me, this is the cool thing about, there's another nice, I would say a tidy metaphor here, which I think we can, I'll lay it out here and then I'll try and make the macro point. So the micro point is that we both arrived at this particular point of view through very different experiences, right? I don't necessarily profess to know yours, whether it was, you know, I know you got your PhD in school and, you know, working with high performers and all, you know, you came at it from a very specific way, as we all do. Mm-hmm. And I came from a very, very, very different, you know, a very different way. Mine was super imperfect. I got 10 years off track pursuing the dreams that everybody else had for me. You know, going to play professional soccer and then was going to go to medical school and bailed on that. And then was going to get this PhD that I just referenced and bailed on that. And I was $100,000 in debt in student loans, and through a very, very messy way that was, I almost died in an avalanche. People close to me died, which helped me, you know, put a different point of view on my vision and mission for my life. And it was a very messy way, but here we are. Uh-huh, right. Uh-huh. You got there through your own way and I got there through my own way. And here we are holding up the same, essentially the same thing, which is mastery. I'm coming at it through creativity. You're coming at it through science and human performance. Uh-huh. And then now to the macro, like to me, that's what is so powerful and exciting about life, the way we're able to live it right now. If you go back 50 years or even through that 20 years, there was still a very prescribed path for everything. If you wanted to be a fill in the blank, it was generally thought that you had to do step A, step B, step C, and step D. And, you know, through whether it's the workforce or through schooling, which is very linear, largely linear, that you had to do this and you had to check in with all these different gatekeepers along the way. And now, what I think is wildly empowering to anyone listening is your way is just fine. That whatever got you to where you are right now, that was critical in building up a set of skills and muscles and mindset that you have now, that you can take, regardless of where you come from, you can take it and apply all the best stuff in you and get anywhere you want to go. There's now a million paths, and the gatekeepers to 90% of the things that you want to be and do in life are gone, thanks to the internet, information moving more quickly, and basically a different structure culturally, which no one cares how you got to where you are because there you are.
It's both a deep philosophical statement as well as a very practical statement, and nobody really cares. You know, there are a lot of people that The arena is scary, and so they'd rather take shots from the outside. And most people are more consumed with themselves than others and only use others as a reflection to make themselves feel better. You know, that's a classic psychological shit talking, trash talking experience for people. And I, do you have scar tissue from that, from other people like saying what a joke he is?
I mean, I'll go back to my second grade classroom. I remember it like it was yesterday. Miss Kelly, I mean, and I was, you know, what do you, in second grade, if you ask any first or second grade classroom, who wants to come to the front of the room and draw me a picture? Every single head goes up.
Yeah.
Because we're all born and wired totally creative, and the system trains it. That system, by the school system, the employment system, culture historically has trained those traits out of us rather than, and told us, you're creative, you're not, etc. And I'll never forget, it was the ice cream social. There were some parent-teacher conferences going on. I walked into my second grade class and overheard Miss Kelly tell my mom that Chase is so much better at sports than he is at art. And right now, if you're thinking, you're like, oh, poor little eight-year-old was crushed. No, eight-year-old me was just like, okay, then I'm not doing this art stuff anymore. I'm going to go be a jock. And then I bathed in that identity for, you know, 10 plus years, and it served me very, very, very well. I went to college on a soccer scholarship. I played on the Olympic development soccer team. I did all those things, but it was at the cost. And to your point about like the labels that other people place on us, how powerful they are, it was at the cost of my creativity for a really long time. And I had to, through my grandfather dying and giving me my camera and me understanding that, wait a minute, I'd been denying this important part of myself. I had to sort of get back into it and get back onto my own path. And yeah, these labels, they matter. And not just words that other people say to us, not just the words that Miss Kelly spoke to me or that your teachers tell you or whatever, but the words that we tell ourselves. Those are the most important words in the world, right? Uh-huh. And this is why you see this. There's a very strong correlation between the world's top athletes, the world's top artists, the world's top entrepreneurs, of A, being willing to be misunderstood for long periods of time, B, being, you know, very in tune with their intuition, and a very powerful mindset that is not, it doesn't necessarily come naturally because it has to be cultivated in order for it to truly be as strong as it needs to in order to, you know, fend off the naysayers. And understanding that the naysayers, those are people that are usually, it's not just some guy up in the cheap seats talking smack. It's often our parents, our coaches, our peers, our teachers, our career counselors. These are people that we like and respect and that are close to us. So to have a mindset that can take in the good stuff, reject stuff that's harmful or hurts us or brings us down, it's a skill that is cultivated and learned and practiced. And the cool thing is, if you can learn, practice, and develop that skill, it is, I think, you know, again, how important is mindset to your work?
That's center point. Yeah. And so how did you, okay, so little scar tissue early on, you know, which caused you to create, it sounds like you're super like functional, like, oh, okay, well, forget it. I'm going to trust the adult and I'm going to go swing over to sport. You invested identity there, whatever. So not really scar tissue there, but more like a trajectory shifter. But you had a creative something that was important to you. Maybe you didn't water it, and that's why you've come full circle as an adult to water that part of you. But I want to go back to the intersection of your grandfather as we kind of started this conversation. But before we go there, one more thing is how your introspective, self-reflective, self-discovery process is evident to me based on the words that you're thoughtfully choosing and the way that you're shaping the conversation. What is your process of investigating your inner life? And I can make it super simple or keep it wide open. I can narrow that down if you want or keep it wide open.
Let me flail around with it for a second.
Cool.
We'll watch it in real time. Watch me flail like a fish here in real time. Mm-hmm. What's my method of investigation?
Yeah. Like your self-discovery process.
I think it's a combination of what we touched on earlier, this willingness to go to a place where you haven't been with a certain amount of trust. Like, I think so much of the world, so it's a willingness to do that, and then a method for managing the fear. Mm-hmm. So it's those two aspects. And I think what the world teaches us that mistakes are bad. I mean, just, you know, go back to any simple childhood memory where you did something wrong and you made a mistake and the mistake was punished. And what we're taught is that making mistakes is bad so that we should avoid them. But what we really should be taught, it's not about avoiding mistakes. It's about error recovery. It's about making mistakes and actually being able to recover quickly from them. And to me, that is we're doing this in real time here. I'm trying to answer the big questions of life from you here. I think that process for me is sort of a willingness, and I believe it comes about from when you make a mistake and recover quickly just a couple of times, there's a part of you, a light switch that flicks on and says, wow, I actually learned something really valuable. I got comfortable being uncomfortable, and now I'm better because of it. That experience is just one click greater than the shame that you would otherwise have felt in a world that told you not to make mistakes. Because there's a world where the shame is outpacing the other aspect. And at some point when your ability to make a mistake and recover is one click north of the shame that you feel from making a mistake, to me, that's this, oh my God, this is the secret.
I love that. I love that because that is what you and I were talking about earlier, is actually the mechanical part of giving yourself and earning the right to say, I can do difficult things, right? Which is like, oh, I have the ability to respond to whatever happens next in life, whether I purposely put myself there or some shit happens and like I'm in the middle of it and I didn't plan, I didn't, you know, whatever. And I'm thinking natural disaster all the way to medical health to something on the side of a cliff, maybe taking a picture that you purposely put yourself there. You know, whatever the mechanical part is or the experience is, that ability to say, oh, hold on, I can adjust, because you got lots of frames of reference to do that.
Yeah, I'll just go back to 45 minutes ago. I was in 50 degree water.
Yeah.
Like, I do that every morning, and I have a cold plunge in my home in Seattle, and here up at the beach, I got the ocean, which in the Puget Sound, any time of year, it's in the low 50s or high 40s, which is very unpleasant. And there's not one time where I'm like, I can't wait to get in this water. It's going to be so awesome. It's always like, I got to go get my ass into that freezing cold water because I'm going to get good at being uncomfortable. Maybe there's another part of that trait. Once you make mistakes, recover quickly, realizing that that's where the good stuff is, that you can actually create a system, a behavioral system for yourself that manufactures that feeling over and over, and then you can get more comfortable, et cetera. I don't know.
Okay. And then when you actually make a mistake, can you call up a time when you've made a public mistake or something that like call up in your memory? It doesn't even need to be concrete for me, but like, how did you adjust? And maybe there's a story around it. Like, I'd like to go into the center of that mechanical response of how you adjust to the mistake.
Well, I think I'm going to lock into what the word I think you used was public. Mm-hmm. I'll go into a very, very public failure. That was originally something that was a big success. And to me, that's part of why I think I'll trot this up, is because it, on the outset, it looked so successful and then became my biggest public failure. Was in 2007, I think, the first phone was enabled with a camera. And it was this terrible little, it was a Palm Treo, and it was at a 0.3 megapixel camera in this phone. And at the time I was shooting, huge global campaigns for the Nikes and the Apples of the world. And I had literally hundreds of thousands of dollars of cameras. I was testing cameras that were never released. I was like on as far on the inside of the camera industry as you can with the best technology available to me. And yet I found this immense joy in taking pictures with my Palm Trio. And again, 0.3 megapixels. I had cameras that were 50 or 100 megapixels that cost $100,000 and were literally the best cameras on the planet. And yet I found a surprising amount of joy in this crappy little camera that I was – that always was in my pocket wherever I went because it was on my phone, right? And I figured out that that experience of I popularized a phrase, the best camera is the one that's with you, because I had always, despite having all that gear, I'd always as a professional, I was still missing amazing moments in my life because it was like, oh man, if I just had my camera with me. And I realized very, very early on that, wait a minute, the future of photography is that every human, certainly every human in the Western world, was going to have a camera on them. And this, I don't know if it's going to happen next year or 2 years or 10 years from now, but this is happening. This is not like a maybe this will happen. This is 100% for sure. So I leaned into this concept of mobile photography, and I was totally ridiculed by my peers. Like, dude, what are you doing posting photos to, you know, again, as this is like early Twitter, early Facebook. And it started getting interesting to me that the pictures that I was taking with these, you know, and then it went from a Palm Trio, it went to a flip phone, and the fact that I had the camera started outweighing the poor quality of the photograph. The fact that I could get that rare moment where most people wouldn't have a camera with them. Of course, we had cameras at weddings and birthdays and all those things, but it was these in-between moments, the moments of life, that I was just so compelled by. So fast forward, that was 2006-07, fast forward to 2009, and Apple had just released, I think it was the second iPhone, and it obviously had a camera, and the camera's getting a little better, and they had just unlocked the ability for anyone to submit software to the iTunes store so that anyone could like create apps basically. And I had submitted what turned out to be the first photo app that allowed you to take a picture and add a cool effect called a filter and then share it directly to these platforms called social media, and had my very own social media platform that was based specifically around photography. So I launched that thing in 2009, and lo and behold, it was the number one app in the App Store. It got App of the Year accolades, New York Times, Macworld, all the wherever those awards happen, and it in large part helped kick off the global photo sharing craze that we knew now. No, this is, you know, 18 months before Instagram, and it's not like I just did a thing. It was the app of the year, like so, you know, millions of downloads, and at that time they were, you know, $3-4, so it was, you know, creating a bunch of revenue, and it was overtly a massive success. And I did, you know, global speaking tour. I did the first book of iPhone photos that ever existed. And what's this, the future of photography? You know, it thrust me into the limelight. And lo and behold, through a series of weird contracts and my relationship with the developer that I had hired, we don't go into the details here. It's well chronicled on the internet. Let's just say I got stuck. And so this, what had been my biggest professional success in my life, made tons of money, put me on the map as a, not just as a photographer, but as someone who is innovating in the space around technology. And I basically got locked out of my own code, and my company went from being crazy successful to a zero. Instagram, which was virtually a lift and stamp copy of my app, which was called Best Camera. They threw $50 million at it, Silicon Valley did, and basically out-iterated and sold for $1 billion a year later. Jesus. So, yeah, and it's like I had run 3/4 of the marathon and they hadn't even started yet. And it was like I bonked at mile 21 or whenever you bonk, and I went no further. And So it took, again, a year and a half for them to trot past me and across the finish line for the $1 billion. So not only was that a very public failure, but it was emotionally super hard, cost me literally $1 billion if you're measuring it. Yeah, and so I chronicle this in my book, Creative Calling. It's well documented on the internet. And the psychology around that is very difficult. And I truly didn't understand how I processed it, or even my ability to process it, until years later. But when I do look backwards, not only was it valuable, but it was critical, absolutely 100%. Creative Live, which has now gone on to affect tens of millions of people, much larger audience than that, not as large as Instagram, sadly for me, but like, I'm very happy with the impact. Creative Live was only possible because of this massive failure. And to me, this is a really important part of our conversation, that I hate books and I hate philosophies that come at it through this lens of perfection. Like, if you do perfect thing A, then perfect thing B and perfect thing C, then you get this perfect life D, E, or F. Versus, like, I've made all these horrible mistakes. Again, I've shared my $100,000 in student debt, 10 years off track doing everything that everybody else wanted. And even in this case, like, massive public failure, way out in front, lose not just some money, but $1 billion publicly. And it was 100% required for where I am today. And I wouldn't have traded it for anything.
Who did you go to? Like, who's your go-to during those types of moments?
Anybody with a shoulder.
Was it tough? Like, was it?
It was very tough. It was, yeah. Yes, it was tough. No, I don't want to over dramatize or over characterize. Like,
yeah,
I had, by the time it actually sold, I had developed a reasonably thick skin. Creative Live, was already underway. But as I mentioned earlier, it took me probably a couple of years after it happened to look backwards and connect the dots and see that A, the experience was so valuable. B, it literally enabled, it made Creative Lives possible. It taught me so much about venture capital and building a business and scaling it, and, you know, all those things that I wouldn't have been able to do otherwise. But to your question, who did I turn to? I turned to the same people that any one of us would turn to, which is our community. And this is one of the reasons why I think community is so critical. Go back to something you said, you know, 30 minutes ago, which is like, nothing happens there's no solo show.
No one does the extraordinary alone.
Nothing happens alone. Mm-hmm. And so the blunt answer to your question is I turned to my community, and these were other entrepreneurs. Either these were other creators, people who had grieved something, you know, whether it's a person or a business or a decision that they've made in their life. I basically turned to my community for guidance, for support, for just friendship and connection in a world that can sometimes, especially when you make a big public mistake, can feel isolated and humiliating and frustrating and all of those ings that go along with the you know, big public failure.
And if you drill right into it, what was the mistake? I'm not sure I totally get the mistake. Yeah.
The mistake it's a little bit esoteric, but I had written a contract in such a way with my relationship with the developer that I had hired, allowed them to basically dictate what the terms of ongoing development of this app were. So again, very narrow, weird, esoteric way to get hamstrung. But essentially the firm that I had hired to build the app, I owned all the code, it was work for hire, and owned everything that they had created. But through a weird series of events, I didn't actually have my hands on the code. It was through their account in Apple. And that was a black box back in 2009 that was very not well understood. So I didn't actually, if I would have done it a different and better way, I would have hired that person. They would have been an employee. We would have launched through our own account on the Apple iTunes store. Essentially, it was very successful, but they thought that apps were flash in the pan and that you didn't keep developing them. So I was way out in front, and then they stopped doing additional innovations on the app, and so it was essentially frozen. And so what I had done poorly is a small mistake, didn't write up the contract in a way that was helpful to me. And then B, which is more importantly, that I stopped taking action against that because I was paralyzed. I was paralysis through analysis. And I didn't at that point reach out to my community. I didn't, you know, go to, you know, seek legal opportunities, seek professional guidance, seek peer support. And I just sort of sat there in it.
Oh God. It feels even worse when you're that specific with it. Oh, sorry to commiserate in something, open up an old wound, but shit, you know, you're reminding me of a time when, I don't think I fully learned this lesson until right now, is that I was courted quite heavily by a, I'm going to keep a lot of these details neutral because the people and the players don't matter, but well, they matter, but not publicly. And I was courted heavily to come work with a company. It was a rising star company and lots of money. They were making lots of money per day and they were well-funded. And the CEO, they just got to the place that the founder left and a professional CEO came in. The CEO and I were building this great relationship. He says, Mike, I want to bring you in full time. It was a 7-figure deal and with stock as well included on top of it. And I dragged my ass because I was like, no, I'm building something. And we went back and forth and negotiated about like, okay, a pro rate of 50% time with us, 50% on your other stuff, be a great base. We'll actually build products with you. We'll co-own them. It was this amazing thing. But I was dragging my ass because I was having a hard time like giving up the entrepreneurial spirit going in-house. And he calls me and he says, I was in the airport and he says, Mike, we're going up to execute, sign on the contract. And this is probably, when I say dragging my ass, it was probably like a 6-month experience, you know, going back and forth, which is too long. That's deal fatigue for sure, especially in Silicon Valley. And I was in the airport going up to have a dinner, sign and execute. He calls and says, Mike, where are you? I said, I'm in the airport. He goes, good news or bad news? Which do you want? I go, and he goes, I'm going to start with the good news. I just accelerated my contract. I go, what does that mean? I have no idea what that means. I do now. He says, well, I had this cool clause that I put in my contract that if the founder ever wanted to come back with no questions asked, I could accelerate my contract in full. I said, does that mean like you're done? And he goes, yeah, good news is I just got paid $53 million and today's my last day. Founder came back. He goes, bad news? He goes, I don't think the founder is going to want to work with you. And I was in the airport. He says, come up. We're going to have dinner. We're going to work together in the future somehow. And, you know, probably just not at this company or definitely not at this company because I'm leaving. We had a good dinner and we haven't figured out how to work together yet, but maybe we're getting close one day. But, oh, I relate.
Let's go back to the top of the hour where recovering from that. And like, I don't think that you think that that wasn't valuable, right? You probably, there's somewhere inside you that's going like, man, I learned a lot in that moment. And that learning is, you know, when you apply that to your future, that is very, extremely powerful. And sort of that's what I mean when I'm retracing, you know, your question around what are the elements to me, this conditioned trusting in your intuition, your gut, and then believing that you can respond to your environment in such a way through repetition and through awareness to get you to become, I don't know, the boss of your own life, or to maybe in your words, to not just have mastered the craft of something, but to become a master of your life.
Yeah, there you go. Okay. Awesome. Let's go full circle. Your grandfather, what was that relationship like?
I think it feels like in that it was characterized as that we were closer than we really are. And by it, I mean, just through the book and through other interviews that I've done, but I think it was just a reverence and an understanding that my grandfather was a cool guy who was passionate about his grandkid and used to like to take pictures. And I think it was equally powerful that my father also was into cameras. And between those two guys, like taking pictures of me as a young kid, as an action sports athlete, you know, skateboarding, BMX, soccer, football, the things that I like to do, it just put me around photography. Remember, this is if you realize that in second grade, I basically cut off that part of me. And then I didn't really acknowledge it until after my grandfather had passed. There's all this time in the middle there where I'm looking at photographs of myself and my friends, and I'm realizing that this is a really powerful medium. This is like these are moments that'll never happen again. And I just remember being struck by that. And so while my relationship, it wasn't like he was a father figure. My father was at home and present, and as was my mother. So but my relationship with my grandfather was less, I think, psychological tension there, and more just an awareness and opening up of this thing called photography, which was both inspiring to me. It created a sense of curiosity and wonder. It was something that was very tangible. It's a skill, it's a craft that you can hone. So all those things to me played really critical roles in getting me excited about it and looking at that as a vehicle through which I could explore my creativity. And then fast forward to his death, and I'm like, literally it's a week before my college graduation. He dies unannounced, dropped dead of a heart attack. No, like, had a heart condition, wasn't feeling well. Like, this was just like done. And then voila, I'm given his cameras. Like, so I took some money that I had gotten from his passing, from my grandmother, and these cameras, and I bought this like 13 stop, like the cheapest ticket you could possibly get to Europe with my then girlfriend, now wife, Kate, and just started, you know, walking the earth and exploring what it was like to take pictures. And it was that, the camera and that experience on the backside of his passing, that truly opened up a world for me where I started to understand my own creativity and how powerful it could be to write my own script rather than do what was prescribed to me, the shoulds, the oughts, the must from culture, that you should go to medical school or become a lawyer or do this thing that's some way revered by our culture versus becoming a photographer. And when you can, it gave me a sense of personal agency that was ultimately, has, you know, shaped my life in a very clear and critical way.
Chase, I can't wait to meet you in person at some point in the Seattle area. Let's make that happen, because I've loved this conversation. Folks that are listening, for community members, like, what would be some very practical things that you would hope that you've developed some insight around that they could also practice and to amplify their creative juices, you know, their creative exploration?
I believe that there's creativity inside of every person, and unequivocal, again, go back to that first or second grade classroom, ask who wants to come to the front of the room and draw you a picture. Every hand goes up. So, you know, whether you're overtly admitting it or not, you know that there's some creativity inside of every person. What I want to tell you is that it's a muscle. It is not some anointment that this, you know, that your second grade teacher or your art teacher or your math teacher tells you are or you're not creative. You are creative. It's a muscle that, like every muscle, the more you use it, the stronger it gets. And then third is that it's only through creating in small daily ways and acknowledging this creativity, whether you're, you know, baking a cake or building a business or designing and executing your life, it's only through those small daily actions that you realize that you actually have agency over this one special life that we have. It's in small daily ways that you understand. It's the same muscle. It's just creativity at a different scale. And to me, that's powerful. So I want people at home to take away that practical knowledge. I, I put it all in the book. It's all in Creative Calling, years in the making. And I think it's a really good, it's a tidy package for these ideas to travel in. So I would encourage you to check that out. And like, look, if for most people, the reason I wrote this book was because there's a gap between where we are in our lives and where we want to be. I know very few people who are, for whom those are exactly the same thing. And they might be for a moment and then there's another gap and they may close that gap and then there's another gap. And that's cool. That's life. But most people were sort of default mode is like a cork in the tide and, oh, where I want to be is way over there. And I don't have a structured way of getting there. The book is a structured way of getting there. And to me, this, you might be 1,000 hours away. You might be 10,000 hours away. You might be 100 miles, whatever the distance between where you are now and where you want to be. It might be far and that could be frustrating, but here's a different way to look at it. You are one decision from getting there. And that is just deciding that that is what you will do. And to me, that's very powerful.
Yeah. All right, Chase. Good stuff. I appreciate you. Yeah, I've really enjoyed this conversation. And, you know, thanks for Stephen Kotler putting us together. You know, a little shout out to Pete Moran for being a good community member, you know. And yeah, I appreciate this. And so I'm looking forward to connecting. And I want to, you know, support folks to go check out the book. And where can they find you online? Where can they get the book? And I know that – I think I just read that you hit the bestseller.
It's less about the accolade. It's more that it's resonating with people, and I'm super excited about that. Right? You've worked for years toiling in the early mornings and late nights writing, and then you put something out in the world. So I'm over the moon that it's hitting the bestseller lists. So it should be easy to find wherever books are sold, Amazon or your local bookstore. It's called Creative Calling. And I think more broadly, definitely check out Creative Live. And, if you want to learn from, you know, the world's top performers. And then I'm just Chase Jarvis, anywhere on the internet. I'd love to see you over in my community. And I want to just take a second and acknowledge the work that you've done. So impressive. Like really, I've looked at your work from afar for a long time and grateful for Stephen for connecting us, just the work you've done on so many different fronts. Obviously I'm a huge fan. I'm a huge Seahawks fan, born and raised with those folks. But just in peak performance and sports, in psychology, I love the work that you do. It's so wide ranging and so powerful. I want you to keep doing what you're doing, and I'm a massive fan, and I will be wherever you go.
Oh yeah, look at that. Let's do it, dude. Let's create a living masterpiece. How about it? And it's Chase Jarvis with a J, J-A-R-V-I-S. Find him on social, get his book. And I hope you've appreciated this conversation as much as the two of us. So with that, brother, looking forward to meet you.
Let's do it.
Yeah. All right. Take care. All right. Thank you so much for diving into another episode of Finding Mastery with us. Our team loves creating this podcast and sharing these conversations with you. We really appreciate you being part of this community. And if you're enjoying the show, the easiest, no-cost way to support is to hit the subscribe or follow button wherever you're listening. Also, if you haven't already, please consider dropping us a review on Apple or Spotify. We are incredibly grateful for the support and feedback. If you're looking for even more insights, we have a newsletter we send out every Wednesday. Punch over to findingmastery.com/newsletter to sign up. This show wouldn't be possible without our sponsors, and we take our recommendations seriously. And the team is very thoughtful about making sure we love and endorse every product you hear on the show. If you want to check out any of our sponsor offers you heard about in this episode, you can find those deals at findingmastery.com/sponsors. And remember, no one does it alone. The door here at Finding Mastery is always open to those looking to explore the edges and the reaches of their potential so that they can help others do the same. So join our community, share your favorite episode with a friend, and let us know how we can continue to show up for you. Lastly, as a quick reminder, information in this podcast and from any material on the Finding Mastery website and social channels is for information purposes only. If you're looking for meaningful support, which we all need, one of the best things you can do is to talk to a licensed professional. So seek assistance from your healthcare providers. Again, a sincere thank you for listening. Until next episode, be well, think well, and keep exploring.